I spoke with Professor Gary yesterday and asked him about the facts in the case. He said they begin with the New York town of Greece opening board meetings with a prayer or invocation.
And what they would do is they'd invite clergy or religious ministers from the surrounding area to be what they call like chaplain of the month. And it would be this person who would deliver the invocation. So that was that's at issue in this case. And it was challenged by some people in the community. There was a challenge made to it, an objection made to it, and the town tried to conform in best they could while still keeping it, and it eventually ended up in a lawsuit.
Now, the appeals court ruled that a reasonable observer would conclude that the town of Greece officially aligned itself with Christianity during the official public meetings, which is, as I understand it, something that the Establishment Clause prohibits?
Yes. The lower circuit court of appeals used what was called the endorsement test. Now, the complicated part of the Establishment Clause area is that the court has a lot of different tests it uses to determine whether there's been an unconstitutional establishment of religion. Almost all scholars in this area agree. If they agree on anything, it's that it's a very confusing and sometimes even contradictory area of jurisprudence because there's so many different tests, and the court uses them sometimes unpredictably and in unpredictable ways. So the lower court used the endorsement test. The issue is, should it have used that test, or should it have used another test? A test like an historical traditions test outlined in a case that was decided about 30 years ago, Marsh versus Chambers, that explicitly approved of legislative prayer or prayer in circumstances like this.
Now, that you mentioned the endorsement test. What is the endorsement test?
The endorsement test pretty much follows what you mentioned, Carl. It just asks, would a reasonable observer perceive that the government was endorsing or establishing or favoring a particular religion, and it's measured by the perceptions of this reasonable person. So it's all focused on the perceptions of a reasonable person. The lower court of appeals said that a person witnessing this practice of invocations could perceive that the town was endorsing the Christian religion.
Now, this gets into the two religion clauses in the First Amendment, the Establishment Clause, which we've been talking about, and then the Free Exercise Clause. And as you were mentioning, these two clauses, oftentimes along with these various tests, that they kind of contradict each other sometimes.
Well, there are two different clauses. Some people say there's just one clause with two different parts, and that seems like a subtle kind of distinction, but it can be important in various different ways. But the two different clauses are a free exercise clause, which more or less is the individual freedom clause. It guarantees to each individual a freedom to practice his or her religious beliefs. The establishment clause, though, prohibits the government from establishing a religion or making a law respecting an establishment of religion. So those can be two sort of different issues, but somewhat related, obviously.
Now, the phrase separation of church and state is used quite a bit, and I'm wondering how well this is understood. Is separation of church and state, does it protect religion from government intrusion, or is it designed to keep the government free of religious intrusion?
Yeah, good question. We probably all have heard of that metaphor, wall of separation between church and state, and it was coined by the Supreme Court in the 1947 case, one of the first cases that the court dealt with the Establishment Clause. Subsequently, of course, people say, is that really an accurate description of the Establishment Clause? Does the Establishment Clause really create a wall of separation between church and state? And this case of Greece versus Galloway brings up or highlights that because the argument that the town will make in the to the Supreme Court in this case is that legislative prayer, in other words, prayer before some kind of legislative body, is a very historical practice, was around at the time of the First Amendment, was around when the Constitution was ratified, and hence the framers and ratifiers of the First Amendment did not mean to make that an unconstitutional type of practice. And the Supreme Court so ruled in the case of Marsh versus Chambers back in 1983. So there's a lot of dispute about separation of church and state and what it really means. Does there have to be an absolute separation whereby there can't be any kind of interaction between religion and government? And, of course, if that's the case, then you also have to address the issues of, well, what about the national motto, In God We Trust, or obviously the Pledge of Allegiance comes into play, or any really sort of interaction between government and religion.
What role does the nature of the meeting play in this case when you're talking about religion and government? As I understand it, the town of Greece, this was a town meeting. Should that make any difference as opposed to, say, a state legislature?
Well, it might. I mean, the court could say that. The court could say that. It might make something of a difference, but most likely the court, I'd be surprised if the court made that kind of distinction. What they've already sort of decided in Marsh versus Chambers that a chaplain, a paid chaplain in the state of Nebraska that offered prayers before the start of a legislative session is constitutional. I think that notion of legislative prayer is probably going to carry through to all kind of legislative venues, state, you know, county, city. But you're right, the court could really say that we're going to treat maybe city council meetings differently from state legislative sessions.
Now, going back to 1983, Marsh versus Chambers, which you mentioned, was that the last time the court took up the issue of prayer and government?
Well, not prayer, but prayer in this kind of setting. They've taken up other issues. For instance, in a 1992 case, I believe Lee versus Weissman, the court said that a prayer offered by a rabbi at a high school graduation ceremony violated the Establishment Clause. But that wasn't what we think of as being legislative prayer. In other words, prayer before a kind of legislative type session. So that was like public prayer. Obviously, the court has also dealt with prayer in schools, and the court hasn't approved of either one of those types of prayers in those kinds of settings.
Why do you think the Supreme Court is taking up the Greece versus Galloway case?
I would be surprised if they were taking up to change the law. I would be surprised about that. They may be taking it just to clarify the law, perhaps, but I'd be surprised if they were going to overrule legislative prayer, because that will then start a kind of chain reaction about what are you going to do about the Pledge of Allegiance, or what are you going to do about the national motto, or maybe even what are you going to do about all the religious scenes and depictions in the state, in the U.S. Capitol, or even in the U.S. Supreme Court building.
Is that why this case is perhaps more complicated than it seems on its surface?
It might be more complicated, I think, because the court hasn't ever settled on tests. Like, for instance, I think it was in 2005, the court approved a display of Ten Commandments on the Texas State Capitol grounds. And there it used the Marsh versus Chambers test, or this historical traditions test, and it approved it. However, the lower court in Greece versus Galloway used the endorsement test, really focused more on that than on Marsh versus Chambers, and by using that test, it struck it down. So I think it comes back to this notion that nobody really knows the clear direction of the Establishment Clause, because there are so many different tests, and depending upon the test you pick, you're going to determine the outcome.
So how do you decide which test to pick?
Well, I guess in a simplistic way, five members of the court decide which guests they're going to pick. But in a more, I think, consistent way, you try to pick the test that you know follows precedent. If you're really dealing with the subject of legislative prayer, the test that has the most precedent would be the Marsh versus Chambers. If you're going to use a different test, then you're going to take a different approach to that and kind of change the direction. So the question to the court is, does it want to keep things the way it's been, or does it want to change direction on this issue of legislative prayer?
Is there a coercion test?
There is a coercion test. That was the test that was used in that case of Lee versus Weissman involving the rabbi's prayer before a high school graduation ceremony. So that's another test. The court used the coercion test to strike down the prayer in that case. Now remember, that wasn't a prayer that might even have been as sort of officially sanctioned as this particular case. But I think the biggest difference was that was before a whole community. Here, the prayer is just before the town board or the town council, and then whatever interested parties might be there at that time. But in a case such as Lee versus Weissman, there is obviously a lot more children in the audience.
So here, a town meeting, since presumably we're dealing mostly with adults, does that have much of an impact in the way this will be argued?
I don't think it will be. The briefs haven't focused on that. The briefs haven't focused that there's primarily adults, so we don't need to worry about it as much. It's an argument you can make, and actually because the Establishment Clause area is so fluid, Carl, you can really bring up just about any argument. But that's not been the argument that the parties have focused on so much. What the real crux of the matter is that which test are we going to follow? And that really depends, too, on are we going to give much weight to this notion of historical traditions? For instance, does the Establishment Clause really mean an absolute wall of separation? Or does it accommodate whatever kind of interactions between government and religion may have existed at the time that the First Amendment was ratified?
Will the Supreme Court's ruling settle anything?
Most likely, it'll settle very little. And the reason it will settle very little, I believe, is that, let me say this. In the First Amendment area, you have the religion clauses, and then you have the speech clauses. And the speech, as most of us probably know, there's been a lot of controversial speech cases. But the speech cases always seem to settle the matter, even though the speech can be horribly objectionable, and we may hate it. The court seems to settle it because it has settled on an agreed-upon approach to it. So even if I hate the speech, I kind of know how the Supreme Court is going to deal with it. Not so with the Establishment Clause. And I think that's why we're not going to get a settlement. We're going to get a resolution of this particular case and this particular issue, but a very narrow issue. In other words, prayer before some official legislative type meeting, but it won't settle much more beyond that.
For those of us who don't teach law, aren't law students, aren't lawyers, aren't students of constitutional law, what should we be looking for in this case? And even beyond that, is this significant? Is this something that we really should be paying attention to?
Well, I think there's big significance. But there's big significance to a lot of the broader themes, you know, that are attached to this. I mean, this is going to be controversial. Of course it's controversial, but it's controversial in large part because the court is divided on the issue. But the court is also divided in the way that American society is divided. And American society is changing in respect. I mean, 20 or 30 years ago, a case like this, you know, would have been perhaps much more ridiculed by the public than it is now. And the public is growing more more secular. And so in that case, I think it's drifting more towards a separation of church and state mentality. So I think it has a lot to do with just kind of the social and cultural boundaries between the public square and religion, and how we're going to intermingle those. I think that's a broad theme that's very important. I think otherwise, the more immediate significance of this case is going to be is that if the court does side with the objectors and strike down this practice, then what is it going to mean to probably more controversial types of issues, like say the national motto and the Pledge of Allegiance?
And when will the Supreme Court issue its ruling?
Well, that's hard to say. I mean, I don't know. So it could be anything, anywhere from a matter of months to, maybe next summer.